Case, I prefer that the courtroom kind of gets settled before we start arguments.
I apologize.
You know, you're fine. Okay, Mr. Pierre.
May it please the court, Fadlan Pierre on behalf of appellant Samuel Scott. Mr. Scott was arrested after he called the police for his own vehicle stolen. Here, a car thief crashed Mr. Scott's vehicle fleeing northbound on foot. 8 minutes later, officers responded to Mr. Scott, located him approximately 2 miles away in the opposite direction.
We have a case of mistaken identity, right? An officer erroneously identifies your client as the suspect. Is that not right?
The officer made a identification based off of a vague description, not that he actually saw my client.
Yep, that's mistaken identity, right?
I want to be careful with the words because based off of the record, it was based off of a description. If the court says that's a mistaken identity, yes, but it's not because he actually saw the suspect's face.
Yeah, he has to make a determination based on all the information available to him about whether this might be the suspect, right?
Probable cause analysis requires that the totality of the circumstances, all the objective evidence, all the events that led up to the arrest be taken into account. Correct, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't he unambiguously say the officer, when he sees him in a group, that he immediately recognized him as the man who had sped past him and then fled the car crash?
And that's what's at issue.
That's what he's, I'm just saying, but that's a fair statement of what he says, is it not?
That's his post-litigation account. Prior to litigation, all of the evidence suggested that he did not see. There's three key evidence that the district court failed to consider. One is his contemporaneous report, which basically says, I saw a heavyset black man fleeing from the crash vehicle. Then there's his police body-worn camera. Anytime, and we've looked, and the court has the body-worn cameras, he never says, I saw that man. In fact, when he speaks to Mr. Scott, he basically says, you fit the description. Third, his deposition testimony.
There was a work ID found in the vehicle, right? And the officer, at looking at that ID, thought that it matched the person who had bailed out of the vehicle, right?
No, Your Honor, it's a little different than that. Here's the events that led up to him getting the work ID. My client called at 5:40 regarding his reported vehicle stolen. 6:05, he engages in a car chase with the stolen vehicle. 6:22, there's a dispatch at the same time the car crash is happening, which basically says the vehicle that has crashed belongs to my client, gives the information, provides the number. In After that, he conducts an inventory. He checks the vehicle. He finds out who the owner is. He has the
work ID.
He gets the work ID. The work ID, and if the court looks to DE 50, Guzman's body-worn camera at T22-4525Z, it's in his hand, and it shows exactly my client's face as well as his name. So, but if we take the reasonable inference at this stage to in light of Mr. Scott.
He has a photograph?
He has the photograph.
And the photograph, at least to the officer, resembles the person who has fled the vehicle?
No. That's not what happened. He has the photograph.
The officer was of sort of two minds in what he said about whether he saw the individual fleeing the vehicle or whether he didn't see the individual fleeing the vehicle. Your argument is that inferences drawn in your favor at summary judgment indicate that he did not get a good view of the person who was fleeing the car.
Based off of the evidence in the record, that would be correct, Your Honor. My argument is that he's making up this story after the fact when all of the evidence shows that he didn't see the person. He saw this vague description of an individual that was running.
Help me with what he actually says under oath when he's subject to confrontation and cross-examination. I thought, and tell me if I've misunderstood this, under oath, in the deposition, he says, and don't misunderstand me, this may be subject to powerful refutation later, but we're here on whether there was probable cause. But do I have it right that he said the Jeep was driving toward him when he saw it speeding? It was driving southbound as he was parked in the median facing northbound. He testified he could see the driver's face the whole time as the Jeep drove toward him. He had, quote, these were his words, full vision of the driver with nothing obstructing his view. And when he arrived at the scene of the alleged car theft, he testified that he recognized Scott as the driver, quote, immediately, because, quote, he had visually seen him committing a crime, that is to say, speeding away and fleeing the scene of a crash. He does say that under oath, right?
He does say that, but there's conflicting evidence in the record at DE 69-3, page 91. Lines 11 through 13, I asked Mr. Guzman, so your first observation of Samuel Scott was from his work ID. That is direct, and he says yes. That is in direct conflict of his...
Bear with me for a moment. Let's accept for the purposes of my question that you have unambiguous testimony saying one thing and lots of other stuff that might undermine the credibility or believability of the deponent. The question we have, though, is whether there was probable cause at the time to effect the arrest. And the probable cause determination generally is characterized as a preliminary determination made initially in an ex parte proceeding. We've said that there may be evidence that undermines it. It may be subject to confrontation and cross-examination. But, quote, finely tuned standards such as proof beyond a reasonable doubt or even by a preponderance of the evidence have no place in the probable cause determination. That's the Supreme Court of the United States tells us that. And so the question we have to ask is whether, looking at the totality of the evidence, viewed from the perspective of a reasonable officer, whether there was a probability or a substantial chance of criminal activity. That's the standard, if I have it right. that we have to measure this against?
Your Honor, we would agree with you. It is not as high as a reasonable doubt standard. That is solidified in the law. What you did say, and I do want to harp on, is that the probable cause standard requires reasonableness. And in this case, based off of the totality of the circumstances, it is not reasonable to assume that my client, who is a heavyset black man, called the police 40 minutes before the incident actually occurred, gets in contact, and in the meantime, by calling another officer, and in 8 minutes runs 2 miles. Your Honor, we take the problem.
That's your strongest argument. Your argument is that and I take what my colleagues have said, and I agree with them, in a normal misidentification case where there's some basis for the identification, the officer gets qualified immunity, or there might be probable cause or arguable probable cause. Your argument is basically that this was a physical impossibility because the car crashes at 6:22. At 6:30, a different officer meets your client 2 miles away, and that it is physically impossible for a person to have gotten 2 miles in 8 minutes unless he or she were going to be very close to breaking the world record for the mile.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And
assuming they were on foot, right?
Assuming they were on foot. And number two, that if you take Officer Guzman at his word that he got a view of the driver, his description does not mention that person having a beard, and your client has a beard.
Exactly.
This one, I think, is physically impossible to grow a beard in 8 minutes.
I would agree with you, Judge Jordan.
Right, so this is not a, I don't know how the case comes out, but this is not a just a normal run-of-the-mill misidentification case, because there are at least a couple of things that indicate that it might have been physically impossible for your client to have been the person who crashed the car and then been somewhere else 2 miles away 8 minutes later talking to a second officer.
In the dispatch under the fellow officer rule imputes the constructive knowledge to all the officers. So all of the officers knew, and Mr. Guzman had actual knowledge of this because he received the dispatch, where my client was at the time of the crash. He knew his phone number. He knew that in his arrest affidavit, he says this was a delayed call, meaning that the dispatch received at approximately 6:22. The call was made at 5:40. So he had that information within his knowledge. So to say that this individual basically did world record time, it was essentially physically impossible for my client to be the individual that stole his own vehicle after reporting it. Your Honor, I see that there's 5 seconds left. Yeah. And
you've saved some time for rebuttal. Why don't we hear from opposing counsel?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Captavilla.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Brian Captavilla on behalf of appellees City of Miami, Bloom, Carrial, and Guzman. I'm joined by Ms. Lourdes Espino-Weidler, counsel for appellee Hernandez. We are seeking this court to affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment, and the court should do so because the district court correctly found actual probable cause at the moment Officer Guzman identifies Scott at the second location. Alternatively, this court could affirm on the basis that there was arguable probable cause at that time as to the federal claims, that the officers were properly afforded state law immunity, and that there is no evidence of malice or bad faith.
District court's order does not lay out conflicting testimony. And that may not be a fatal error because, as Judge Marcus said, we're determining probable cause, which is not a heavy standard. But the district court's order seems to take the defendant's version of events as a given. Doesn't draw any inferences against them. Doesn't mention the possibility that it's physically impossible for someone on foot to have gone 2 miles in 8 minutes, and to have been the person who crashed the car and the person who was met by a different officer to discuss the theft of the car. doesn't mention the lack of a beard on the suspect by Officer Guzman and the fact that Mr. Scott had a beard. I mean, none of those things are in the district court's recitation of the summary judgment record. Now, like I said, that may not lead to reversible error, but it doesn't seem like the district court viewed the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Scott. Can you tell me your response?
Sure. Well, to begin, Your Honor, we disagree. I do agree with you that the beard is not mentioned, but I don't think that that creates a reversible error. The district
isn't it an important issue to consider, given that this is a misidentification case and the suspect did not have... If Officer Guzman is taken at his word that he got a good view of him, right? And he doesn't say that he had a beard, and now Mr. Scott has a beard, isn't that important? It may not be determinative, but isn't it important?
Well, there are cases that we cited in our brief that explain that these descriptions don't have to be perfect. Right, policing is not perfect.
Agreed. That's why I'm saying, that's why I prefaced the question with, it may not lead to reversal. It may not be reversible error. But the district court's recitation of the facts doesn't seem to take anything in the light most favorable to Mr. Scott.
Well, may I provide you an example of how it did consider things in his favor? So, for example, the record... the appellees were consistent in saying that the record supports an arrest time, or rather a crash at 6:05, and that the call was made at 6:22. In fact, today, Mr. Pierre provides a different telling of the events, but the district court took his version of events as true in that regard, saying that the crash transpired at 6:22. So,
I'm sorry, that end, the crash occurred at 6:05 or 6:22?
6:22.
I'm sorry, are you telling us it's 6:05 or 6:22? I may not have heard you clearly.
It's our position that the crash transpired at 6:05. The record supports that, and the documents that Mr.
But your opponent.
But however, but to the point of 6:22, which was accepted by the district court in his favor, which provides a much narrower window.
At a wrong address.
But still a reasonable officer.
The district court flipped the avenue and streets, which makes a huge difference in Miami, which is set on a quadrant. District court said the crash took place at 515 Northwest 72nd Avenue. That's by the Palmetto.
Well,
that is about 7 to 8 miles away. That's what I'm telling you. The district court's order seems skimpy to me with regard to the recitation of the summary judgment record.
Well, as you may recall from Cariel's description in his deposition, the first location and the second location took him approximately 4 to 5 minutes to arrive. So if Mr. Scott had assistance with a vehicle to get from the first location to the second location, that would certainly make sense as to how he arrives at that location and how he obtains this black shirt that he throws on top of the white tank top. So to that end, a reasonable officer doesn't need overwhelmingly convincing evidence. This is a reasonable officer standard, and arguably, a reasonable officer could also conclude that Mr. Scott got to the second location with a little bit of assistance. And as a reminder, Officer Bloom in his testimony explains that when he arrived at 6:30, Mr. Scott was nowhere to be found. So he circled and drove around the neighborhood, and again, Mr. Scott was nowhere to be found. Eventually, Mr. Scott appears, as we all know, a little bit winded, and he provided meandering and varying alibis.
So at what time does he appear?
It appears he... As far as we can tell, it looks like it's approximately 6:35. So that gives him a little bit more leeway to get there. It's not entirely clear, but it's certainly not 6:30 when Officer Bloom arrives at the scene because he has to drive around the neighborhood to find Mr. Scott.
So your answer is it's possible if he drove.
It's possible.
You would agree with Judge Jordan if he was on foot, he couldn't have done it.
If the crash...
Unless he was really a marathon sprinter, and there's no evidence of that.
I think if the crash happened at 6:22, which is not our position, we believe the crash happened at 6:05, and I can explain that to you if you like.
You can, and you have a basis for it, but it's a summary judgment standard, so you've got to look at facts and inferences in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Well, I would like to explain to you why we don't believe that's a genuine and material dispute to that end, and why the record supports a 6:05 crash time, Your Honor. But to your question, Your Honor, and it was... to the question of could 6:22 be possible, with the assistance of driving, but certainly not
or a scooter. I mean, driving back to the hotel yesterday, passed by the, you know, these stand-up scooters that are ubiquitous now in urban in major cities. They certainly exist in Miami. Last time
that's
I checked,
that's correct, Your Honor. But to your point, Judge, Your Honor, the exhibit that Mr. Scott relies upon to say a 6:22 crash time transpired is this crash report that was prepared by Officer Brandon Williams. During his deposition, Officer Brandon Williams says that he wasn't there when the crash transpired. He relies on a CAD report. The CAD report, the only CAD report in this record, mind you, is a CAD report for a stolen vehicle at 6:22. So there is no CAD report for a crash in this record. That CAD report appears as ECF number, I believe it's 69-10.
So your answer boils down to, one, the crash may have occurred at 6:05, and he wasn't found until 6:35. Alternatively, if it's 6:22, there were 13 minutes, in which case he could easily have gone on a scooter, as Judge Pryor mentioned, or driven, and so that it's not so implausible as to render the eyewitness identification so worthless of belief that the court could not rely on it for a probable cause determination.
100%, right. Your Honor, yes. And that essentially goes to the...
What about the problem with the beard? Yeah. What are we to make of that?
I agree a beard cannot be grown in...
Particularly when he testifies with great clarity. I was able to eyeball this man in the car. He was coming my way, and I saw him for an extended period of time. I saw him full face.
Well, I think the body-worn camera footage also shows that the beard was quite low. So to that end, I think that these identification cases don't require perfection. But Mr. Scott indisputably is tethered to that car because there's other objective indicia of guilt. So, for example, it's undisputed that it's his vehicle. It's undisputed his ID is there. But setting that aside, more importantly, he's not at the scene where he says he's supposed to be. And on top of that, he then gives different alibis as to where he is. He even goes so far as to say his car was stolen in the city of Miami Gardens, then he takes a bus, and then he decides he's going to report his stolen vehicle in the city of Miami, even though it was stolen in the city of Miami Gardens. But, and then on top of that, he said...
I thought he explained that he was at a relative's house, and that's where the vehicle was stolen.
The record shows that he provided various stories, but one of the stories that he provided during his deposition, Your Honor, is that...
I want to know what the officers knew at the time.
What the officers...
At the time, his version of events was, if I'm not mistaken, that he was at a relative's house with his children, and he left his car there when he went inside, and when he came back outside, the car was stolen. And that's what the officers were told with the stolen vehicle report that he phoned in, right?
That is not entirely accurate. He provides various stories to different officers. But I want to add that his reaction to seeing his stolen car was not to go inside of the home or to call police immediately. A reasonable officer could not believe him because his explanation didn't make much sense. He said that he decided to walk around the neighborhood to see if somebody moved his car as a prank. I see my time is running up. Unless there's any further questions.
Finish answering that.
But essentially, yeah, but to your question, I think that a reasonable officer does not have to believe protestations of innocence or alibis. Your Honor, Judge Jordan and Chief Judge, I think it was Chief Judge Pryor in Williams versus City of Montgomery, talk about Hill versus California, that talk about these mistaken identity cases and that these cases don't require perfection. Another example is this court's holding in Rodriguez, which found that a difference of 5 inches in height was not enough to reverse for probable cause. And we know that we have a 4-inch height difference here, but...
Okay.
Thank you. And in all other respects, I rely on my briefs, and I'll hand that over to Ms. Espino Weidler. Thank you.
Yeah, Ms. Weidler.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Lourdes Weidler, on behalf of retired officer appellee Miguel Hernandez. The majority of the argument this morning has relied on whether or not there's an existence of probable cause. During my portion of the argument, I'm going to address that there are other outs for these appellees, officers, and for this court to affirm summary judgment on the basis of either arguable probable cause, and as it relates to my client, Mr. Hernandez, who is the only appellee where they're seeking the search claim on him, all he needs is either arguable reasonable suspicion or reasonable suspicion, which are all lesser standards than the lenient standard of probable cause as opposed to a civil case or a criminal case. I'd like to...
Arguable probable cause, would you agree with me, means that the burden on the plaintiff is to establish that the absence of probable cause was clearly established as a matter of federal law.
Right, but they could be reasonably mistaken as to the identification. And as it relates to the assistant...
In other words, you could, looking at clearly established federal law, reasonably err and conclude that there was probable cause, and you would be entitled then to the benefit of arguable probable cause.
Yes, the shield of qualified immunity would be present for these assisting officers. The issue of probable cause is specific to Officer Guzman. These officers reasonably relied on his positive ID at the second location. I want to point court.
How much communication was there between Officer Guzman and Officer Hernandez about what had transpired?
So,
I thought there was a little bit of a gap in terms of what one told the other or what the other one learned.
And you're right, Judge Jordan. The Axon video camera and the testimony specifically shows that before Hernandez was about to conduct a limited pat-down search on Mr. Scott, there was no direct communication between him and Guzman. However, they all pulled up to the scene together. We hear on the camera, that's the bailout. Bloom repeats it, that's the bailout? All of this in front of Officer Hernandez and Carrie L. Then, for 30 seconds that elapse, you see these three...
Before the first pat-down or between the first and second search?
Before the first pat-down. There's 30 seconds when Hernandez and Bloom actually give each other a hug. They hadn't seen each other in a while. And then you see my client gesture over to the plaintiff, and they're talking about it. 30 seconds. You don't hear it. It's inaudible in the camera. But these gentlemen testified 4 years after the fact, I'm almost sure we talked about the bailout. And it's my client's position, and there's no evidence in the record to support any type of fabrication, that he believed reasonably, and even if it was mistaken, that the suspect on site on that Signal 22, which was a stolen vehicle, was the same person that Officer Guzman saw. I'd like to point the court to one of your honor's opinions, Vickers versus Georgia. This is a case regarding the fellow officer rule. And it's true what you mentioned, Judge Jordan, that there was no direct communication, but the fellow officer rule is also considered collective knowledge, collective rule.
The knowledge of one is imputed to the other.
That is right. And let me get on the facts of that case because it's almost identical. Even the appellant's claim of misidentification or it wasn't me, I didn't commit the offense, it's impossible, is the exact same thing that was argued in Vickers. And there's two officers. Officer Jenkins observes an individual trying to break into a car. It's late at night in a dark parking lot. Suspect gives on foot. He starts chasing him. He loses him. Officer Knapp is told a description. What's the description? It's a black man in a hoodie. A short distance away, the short distance isn't explained in the opinion, they see him. He apprehends him. Guess who comes over? It's Officer Jenkins, and he says, that's the guy. In that Vickers opinion, this court found that there was probable cause for the arrest.
Can I ask you, I understand that argument, so I'm sorry if I'm interrupting, but you're running on your time. If you win only on arguable probable cause and not actual probable cause, what does that do to the remaining claims? Do they have to be resolved on the merits?
No. The remaining...
Arguable probable cause knocks out the state claims too?
It would not.
Right. That's what I'm suggesting.
But there's statutory immunity under 768.
No, I'm not.
They just have I'm not saying, right?
I'm not saying you'd lose on them. I'm just saying if you only get arguable probable cause, you have to address those other claims on the merits, right? You can't just use probable cause as the knockout for all of them like the district court did.
Right.
If you have probable cause, that's the end of everything for everything. But if you only have arguable probable cause, then you have to reach the other claims on their merits.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Got it.
Yes. Aside from Vickers, we rely on Williams versus Miami-Dade Police, even if it is established that Guzman provided false information, although not supported by this record, the assisting officers would still be entitled to qualified immunity and probable cause would still be in existence. We ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pierre. Save 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, Your Honor, I'd like to address the case of what it is a case of mistaken identity. Our version of the facts, in which this court must accept at the summary judgment stage, is that this was a fabrication, that he never, in fact, actually saw my client. He saw a heavyset black male running northbound, and my client was located southbound. In addition, there's key evidence in the record that shows that when he gets the lanyard, and if he actually saw my client as the court intimated when he was driving, he doesn't radio the police officer saying that this is a person of interest. He continues with his investigation. Regarding the timing, Your Honor, the opposing counsel suggests that the timeline that we have stated, that the crash didn't occur at 6:22, it occurred at 6:05. Your Honor, here's where we get our support in the record. At 5:40, Officer Guzman says in his arrest affidavit, that's when the call occurred. He says at 6:05, this is when the incident occurred, not when the crash occurred. Regarding the 6:22 time, we get it from Brandon Williams' testimony where he basically said, I got all my information from Officer Guzman. So he placed the 6:22 in the record. Regarding the dispatch, the CAD report lays out when the call was dispatched to the officers. So, and then regarding the 6:30 time, Officer Bloom testifies in his deposition exactly when he arrived at the scene. He says 6:30. So our timeline is supported by the record, which makes it unreasonable to believe that my client could have been the individual who did all of these things in 8 minutes' time. Regarding...
Let me ask you just one very quick question, if I can. I take it you agree that if all they can establish is arguable probable cause, not probable cause, there isn't a sufficient basis to kick the claim against the city.
Exactly, Your Honor. I would agree with that. They would still have to stand trial on the issue of the false arrest as well as the malicious prosecution.
They couldn't use 768.289A, right?
They could not because...
But that's what the district court went off on against the city, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. The 768 was an unraised argument. So even if this court found that there was no arguable probable cause, the city and the officers would still have to stand for trial on the state claims.
Even if there was arguable probable cause?
Yes, even if there was arguable probable cause.
But that would still... You would have to establish that there's evidence of willfulness or bad faith or intent, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What? Where's the evidence of that?
That's the whole issue. It's because the district court didn't rule on the sovereign immunity issue as to the officers. It ruled on the sovereign immunity issue as to the city, which was not raised. So that is at that's fair game. So they would have to stand trial.
You get one or the other. If there is only arguable probable cause, then the state claims have to be resolved on their merits. If there's no willfulness or bad faith on the part of the officers, then you've got a claim against the city. If there is willful or bad faith conduct on behalf of the officers, you get to go against them, but you can't go against the city.
Yeah, it's mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly, Your Honor.
We got you.
For the reasons stated in... Okay.
well, go ahead.
For the reasons stated in the record, we request that this court reverse the district court's ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Pierre. We're going to move to the next case.